Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil DeBole is back with us. He is the president of Prairie Nursery. He's co-author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants and certainly recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. So we're going to talk with him about how to design a prairie garden and, of course, answer your questions as we go along. And I'd love to hear from you. What would you like to know about adding natives to your landscape? Maybe you're looking for recommendations for natives for a specific area. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Neil DeBole, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be on your show again as we move inexorably towards spring.
are you getting into the busy season or probably well into it?
We are well into it, yes, and that's a great thing. We're very happy for it, and I like it when spring is gradual, and, you know, it was getting really hot really fast, like, this is wrong, and all of a sudden we got that corrected, and now it's moving at a more normal rate, and that's good for everything.
Well, I wanted to talk to begin about designing a prairie garden, and you know, when I think about designing a garden, I think more of the structured English flower gardens and so forth. Why do we need to design a prairie garden?
Well, it's like any garden. You want to make sure that it is a cohesive amalgamation of plants that are going to give you beauty and joy throughout the entire seasons, if not all four seasons. And that's the beauty of prairie gardens, is because typically you will include grasses in a prairie garden, because a prairie is, by definition, a grassland. And the inclusion of grasses gives you late season interest in the fall with the different structures and colors that the grasses turn. And then they also generally are a little taller, maybe 3, 4, 5, or 6 feet tall, depending, or more. And they will give you fall and winter color, even into the winter. And birds will rummage around among the flowers, the grasses, et cetera, for food. So the winter garden can be just as exciting as the spring, summer, and fall garden from another standpoint, from the aspects of more subtle colors, but also wildlife utilization. The butterflies may be gone, but the birds will still be in there. And that's a really good thing in the winter when there's not much else going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do people usually go wrong when they're planting a prairie garden?
Well, let's talk about gardens in general. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners have been to England, where really, if you could say who are the greatest gardeners in the world, I think you could say the English, the Japanese, some would argue the Italians, but I think the English pretty much take the cake. And when you go on garden tours or just look at gardens in England, how much mulch do you see?
You don't see any.
You don't see any. And why is that? That's because English gardeners know their plants.
Yeah.
And American gardens are basically mulch piles with a few plants stuck in them. Because, you know what, it's dumb and easy. Okay, I hate to be, you know, negative, but that's really, you know, that's really what you see. You see a big pile of mulch and there's a few plants arranged in it. But, and that's, I'm being a little extreme here, but by knowing your plants, you have to know not only the foliar characteristics, but you also need to know the rooting zones. And the beauty of prairie gardens is that you are using those roots, those fibrous, dense roots, especially of the grasses, to occupy the soil, which then keeps weeds at a minimum, because it's those dense roots that prevent open soil where weeds grow. So that's why grasses are not only important from a seasonal interest, also from a support interest. You don't have flopping plants in the prairie because those grasses are competing with them and absorbing nitrogen so that your plants don't get tall and leggy, so you don't have to go there and stake them. My God forbid, can you imagine going out and having to stake all the plants in your garden? That's just such a waste of time. And then this whole deadheading thing where you go and cut the tops off. I'm like, why? I'm pro-life when it comes to prairie plants. Don't cut the heads of the seeds off. So you have a lot of different approaches to this. And then the really interesting part for me, as I mentioned earlier, is leaving the prairie stand over the winter for wildlife. And a lot of people, they want to clean everything up as soon as the flowers are done and mow it down and rake it off, and if they're lucky, throw it in the compost pile, or worse, put it in a plastic bag and put it out on the curb. No, that's really not a good idea. So you can leave that garden stand, and there's all sorts of insects, pollinators, invertebrates that overwinter in the stems, in the leaf litter, over the winter, and then that's the next generation the following year. And if you cut it all down in the fall, then you just take away the whole new generation of pollinators, invertebrates, et cetera. So you not only get the interest of the garden, you also get birds coming in there, and they're looking for the insects and the seeds and everything. And I know people that plant their prairie gardens specifically for birds all year long. So there's a lot of aspects to the garden design that can be very beneficial in the human enjoyment, not only during the growing season, but also in the winter.
Yeah. Can Sauk Prairie has a question about your book, I believe. Let's take a shot with Kay. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I was fortunate to be gifted a copy of Neil's book, which I greatly enjoy, and I can appreciate why now it took him so long to get it all together. But my question is, understanding the map that is on every page with each plant, the dark green, the light green, and the yellow.
Yes.
What's the information there?
Well, this was an oversight during the publishing process, and the second printing is being done, and they're going to correct that. So that we'll have a key that shows this. But the dark green indicates, you'll notice that dark green encompasses an entire state. So if it's dark green, that means that the plant is known to occur in that state. Then the individual light green are individual counties where those plants actually have been documented, put in herbarium specimens or otherwise somehow professionally and scientifically documented. The yellow fill is the counties where the plants are found, but these are considered rare within that state. So the yellow color indicates rare. Light blue indicates that it is adventive, meaning that it is not believed to have been native to that area prior to European settlement, but has since been placed there, grown there, gardened with there, and therefore is now located in that state. And then there's also a brown color, which indicates that the plant was known by record to have occurred in that county, but is no longer there and has been extirpated from that state, meaning it is no longer present in that state due to development or some other loss of habitat. So, and it was a terrible oversight, but it's being corrected. The second printing is being done now. So I have been assured by the publisher that that map will now be included with the second printing. Now, to find out more, you can go to the website from which those were derived, and that is the Biota of North America program. You don't have to remember that. Just go to www.bonap.org. And then in the upper left-hand corner, kind of to the left side, click on plants by genus, G-E-N-U-S. And I think, or maybe it's either associated with that or near that, it'll show map key. And you can go to the map key, and that will explain everything with the colors. But that map key will be in the second printing of the book.
It's actually, Kay, thank you, by the way. It's good to know that you're into a second printing, so sales have been good.
Yeah, I guess. I think the first printing was 7,500 books, which is, I mean, it's not a lot, but I guess for a book, I guess that's considered pretty good, and that was about a year ago that they started selling it. So, but you know, this book was designed by my co-author Hillary Cox and myself to be really a timeless reference. It's not something that's going to go out of style, you know, unless people stop planting prairie plants, but I doubt that that's going to be the case because they really are the plants of the future, especially with water issues becoming more and more prominent, and people are not going to be able to irrigate as much potentially as water becomes probably more scarce. We don't really know. But the book was designed to have a long lifespan because it's a reference book. It's not so much a style book as it is a reference book. So hopefully we'll sell thousands and thousands more. And we've been really good feedback, and people really like it. So it was worth the 22 years it took to do it.
And again, it's The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. I have my copy right next to me, just to my left. And it is a wonderful book. Well, Kay, thanks again very much for calling. And Barry, yeah, go ahead, Neil.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure people know that Prairie Nursery does not sell this book, but you can get it online at like Barnes & Noble or Amazon or any online bookseller. There's no way we can compete with them, so we don't offer this, but you can find it online, no problem.
Okay. Barry in Bangor has a question that I think I was going to bring up next, so I think. Let's go there. Hi, Barry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning to you, Neil.
Morning.
We have about 2 acres up here near Bangor, up in the Driftless area, that we want to convert into a prairie, and we cut it down late last summer. We dug it several times, and I've been out and disked it twice already this spring. I want to try and avoid spraying it with Roundup. And what I want to ask you is, if I dig this thing, let's say, once a week, all summer long, and then late in the fall, like, let's say, September, just let it lay idle until any remaining seeds come up, and then spray it at that point, and then plant it in, like, November. Does that make sense, or?
Well, we have about 10 things going on here, so let me start with this. What was originally growing there? What was the original vegetation before you started the site preparation process?
Just grasses, some weeds. That's about it.
It was an old farm field?
Yeah.
Okay, so just an abandoned farm field that grew up to grasses, weeds. No trees, no shrubs, or anything like that?
Nope.
Okay, got it. Okay. So if you look at your various options for site preparation, you do have the option of repeated tillage, which is what you're proposing. Another option is to use herbicides like a broad-spectrum herbicide like glyphosate or Roundup, same thing. And there is also the option of using smother crops like a buckwheat, winter wheat, or winter rye rotation, buckwheat in the summer, winter wheat and winter rye fall, winter, and spring, which is an organic method that you would pursue for 2 years. And the method that you're using, it's too large an area for smothering, obviously, so you wouldn't go out there and put cardboard or black plastic or old rugs over it like you could for a smaller garden area. So your method will work. I've used this method. And you have to know what your weeds are. And when you say digging, how are you digging into this? What tool are you using to dig?
An old-fashioned farm digger.
Is that a quack digger or a cultivator? What exactly are you using?
No, it would be a quack digger.
A quack digger where it has an eccentric gear and it actually lifts the rhizomes out of the ground?
Yep.
Okay, wow, you got an old Van Brunt quack digger. I used to use one of those, made in 1936.
Well, you wouldn't believe it. This is about a 1952 Alice Chalmers with a 6-foot digger attached to the back.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, whoo, you got yours is more modern. At any rate, so yes, you can do that, but rather than do it weekly, the trick to this game is you want to exhaust the roots of the plants that you're digging. The one problem with the quack digger is it's great on quackgrass and other grasses, but it does not attack taprooted species because the taproots do not get dug up very well by the tines. Okay, so you might find that there, if there are taprooted species, you may not be able to eliminate them. So it does depend on what the target weeds and grasses are. But if you don't have a lot of taproots, you can go through there approximately once a month. And the reason you want to go once a month rather than once a week, although you could go out there and do it once a week, but it's really a waste of your time. You want to disturb those roots, and then the plants, the leaves die back from the disturbance. You want to do it during very hot, dry weather where you go out on the first day of a high-pressure system, so there'll be 4 or 5 days of warm, dry weather to desiccate those roots. Then you want them to resprout because you want them to exhaust some of their energy in the roots of the survivors and let them resprout about 2 or 3 inches, and then you go out there again and dig them up. So now they have expended their roots, what remains of their reserves and their roots, and they made new leaves, and you go out there and beat them up again. They don't like that. That's not good. If you do that all summer long, you should have a completely clean field with the exception of species that cannot be eliminated by this method, which would include some really tough ones like Canada thistle. Field bindweed is very difficult to eliminate this way. And crown vetch, those are your three big ones. And interestingly, those three species are generally resistant to glyphosate, i.e. Roundup. So they're in a special category all unto their own where you need to use a specific broadleaf herbicide and really to effectively eliminate them. Although sometimes you can get lucky with glyphosate and kill Canada thistle if you hit it at exactly the right time, usually at the early flower bud stage, but usually it takes 2 or 3 applications to kill it. So, yes, you would be then ready to seed in the fall. However, this is the drawback to using cultivation is that every time you cultivate, you bring up new wheat seeds from the subsoil. The advantage of using an herbicide method is that you just leave it sit all year and you just spray it 3 times, usually once in late May, once in mid-summer, and once in late summer and September. And now any seeds that germinated would have also been killed by the application of the herbicide, and then you have a lower weed density situation because you didn't bring up all these new weed seeds. And I should point out it will do you little or no good to spray in the fall for weed seeds that germinate, because most weed seeds germinate April, May, June into July. You get very little weed seed germination in the fall, so spraying then would only kill those species that germinate in the fall, leaving all the others just dormant to come up the following spring. So it's probably a waste of time to do that fall spraying. So you have your options.
There you go, Barry. Thank you so much for calling. Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery. He's a consulting ecologist. Great to have him with us. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today, our technical director, Tyler Ditter. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR. Taking a look at designing and growing a prairie garden in on your property today, we're talking with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him with us. Neil, Carolyn emailed us. Her garden, her prairie garden, is being overrun by white vervain. It was not supposed to be in the seed mix they purchased. Their garden is a third of an acre. She's wondering what they can do. I'm trying to think about white vervain. All I can remember is some people get a rash from it, I think.
Oh, boy. White vervain is a pretty pervasive, some people consider it a weed. In this case, it is a weed because it's a plant where you don't want it. And it's an early successional plant. It's not usually long-lived. It's a short-lived perennial. So I'm assuming that this is probably a fairly young prairie. Do we know the age of the prairie?
We don't.
Okay. So if a prairie is maturing properly, usually by the fourth and fifth year, you'll start to see most annual weeds will be on the run. Biennial weeds, with some notable exceptions, will usually start to fade, although there are things like sweet clover, yellow and white sweet clover, Queen Anne's lace, some of these will persist. Wild parsnip can also be problematic. But the white vervain is a relatively short-lived plant, so you would expect that it should start to fade over time, unless the prairie is not developing properly and you don't have the proper density of prairie plants to squeeze out the early successional weeds like white vervain. So I will tell you, I have never had to deal with it on a long-term basis, and I'm hoping that this is a young prairie and that this is not going to be an ongoing problem, but really, really hard to say. So.
There you go, Carolyn. Thank you so much for that email. Mark and Stevens Point, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. My question is about switchgrass and site preparation. I've bought seeds from you in the past and have had really good success with my prairie. And what I'd want to do is create a border that on one side would be about 10 feet wide by about 100 feet long. And then in between the prairie plants, which are coneflowers and black-eyed Susans and some other mixtures that I've purchased from you before, I've mowed it. So there's a border an area in between that is about 15 feet. So the prairie won't creep into the border and vice versa. My question is the site prep on the switchgrass, the 10 foot by 100. Right now, it's just various weeds and grasses, and it's next to the road. So my purpose is to have a taller border. Well, there could be some habitat in there. It's close to not a very busy road, but a road, so it's not likely to get a lot of activity. And how would you recommend site prep on that?
That depends on whether you want to do it organically or with herbicides.
Ideally organically.
Okay. Well, we just talked about that.
Yeah,
I know. I was on the phone. I caught the end of that. So similar situation than the previous call. But
It's basically the same. If these are perennial weeds and grasses, then you'll need to spend at least a year cultivating it once a month during the growing season. I would start as soon as it starts, when it gets about 4, 5, 6 inches tall in the spring, go in there and dig down. What kind of equipment do you have? Do you have a rototiller or a cultivator, or what do you have that you can dig with?
I have a rototiller. I also have a drag that I could, with tines on it that I could pull over it.
With a drag? Oh, with tines. Okay, not with nails or spikes, but actual tines?
Correct.
The best thing, would be the rototiller and set it as deep as you can go. It does depend upon the weeds that you're trying to get after, but a rototiller will usually be able to go 6 to 7 inches deep. So you can certainly go in there and churn that up. And if you go in there about once a month, April, May, June, July, August, September, and then you can, that should pretty much kill everything. So, and I'm assuming you're not on a slope, so you would not be creating an erosional situation by keeping the soil open. Is that correct?
It's fairly flat.
Fairly flat.
Yeah, my question is for seeding with, I didn't catch the previous caller what they were putting in. This is switchgrass.
Sure. It's a site preparation process. It's pretty much identical for whether you're putting in a prairie mix with flowers and grasses or just grasses, or even a garden. If you're doing a small garden, you just want to make sure it's completely free of all perennial weeds. It's impossible to get rid of all the weed seeds unless you sterilize the soil. And, you know, you can do this. You can sterilize the soil, but if you have a wood pile or you have a bunch of brush, you can burn that. And that will sterilize the surface soil, and then you can go in there and just rake that burned soil and put your prairie seed in there, and you'll have, like, no weeds.
All right. There you go,
Mark. Don't need for lime. So, and you don't need much switchgrass. You can put a quarter pound. If you can get it evenly distributed, a quarter pound will cover 1,000 square feet and then some.
All right. Mark, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jean emailed, wondering if you have any suggestions for what to plant over a septic system. The area abuts a cornfield. She'd like plants that attract pollinators and not disrupt the septic system.
Sure. Well, we actually have a septic prairie seed mix.
Ah.
And this, I've used this. Well, I put this on our, 42 years ago, I planted and did the first one. Of course, I used our septic system as the test, and it worked great. And I'll tell you a really interesting story. This is designed for systems. This is to be planted into the sand and gravel backfill. It is dry prairie species that grow in sand and gravel. If topsoil was put on it, this will not work. Do not use this mix. Then you can just use a regular mix, like on a septic system, like our short prairie for medium soil. If there's 6, 7, 8 inches of nice topsoil, use a medium soil mix. You can use our pollinator mix. You can use, which has short grasses, but taller flowers, some that can get anywhere from 2 to 6 feet tall in the pollinator mix. And that's a great mix. It has real diversity, but it might be a little too tall for that situation, in which case you might want to use a short prairie mix. But anyway, so I used a dry prairie mix on our new septic system. And then the tank failed after 30-something years. And so we thought we'll just replace the tank. The drain field should be fine. And, of course, when I say on the septic system, I mean the drain field where they put the sand and gravel backfill was where we seeded this. So they come in and they say, yep, we can fix this tank. But, oh, guess what? We've changed the rules. Your distance to the modeling, M-O-T-T-L-I-N-G, near the water table, well, we've changed the rules, and now you are no longer in compliance, and you have to put in a $10,000 mound system. Which is why people hate government. I'm not one of them, but that's what that drive you crazy. They dug up our now 30-something-year-old drain field, and they said it was as good as the day it was installed.
Oh.
And we had to spend $10,000 on a mound system that we didn't need. But that prairie had been on there 30-something years, and that system was beautiful, pristine, and great. And, you know, it sucks up all that crap out of there, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's recycling right there into the prairie. So we have – and I talked to these guys before we did this in the DNR. They said that when DNR used to regulate septics, they no longer do. But these guys said they had exhumed like 110 failed septic systems, and they had never once seen an example of herbaceous plants compromising the system. Trees, shrubs, et cetera. Woody plants, yes, they get into the pipes and clog them up. They had never seen any problems with herbaceous plants. So I said, well, prairie's got to work, and it did for ours. So, and many people have done this very successfully.
Very good. And I love the story. I'm sorry about the story, but it was a good story.
You know, those are the rules. I mean, the whole idea here is to protect the environment. I mean, that's what we do here. Okay.
Yeah.
But it was in this case, it was really completely unnecessary. But, you know, they make up new rules, and we were in compliance originally, but then they change it, and you're kind of like, huh? I got to do what? Anyway, it was all in well-intentioned, but unnecessary.
Dustin in Oregon has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, I had a question on cut plants, two of them. One, can they be cut back for just to reduce height? And then I know they're quite aggressive. Would common ironweed be kind of aggressive enough to be around them without kind of getting taken over? Or is it pretty much just going to run over those as well?
Okay, when you say cut back, you mean cut back during the growing season to keep them from getting too tall, correct?
Yes, to reduce the height.
Yeah. You would be hard-pressed to hurt cup plant. So you can whack at it all you want, okay? You don't want to do it like 10 times a year, but you can go in there and cut it back like in July or something, and then it'll resprout and grow new stems, okay? And then nothing is going to compete with cup plant. Nothing can beat it. It's a very aggressive plant. It's a phenomenal wildlife plant because it provides all the needs for birds. Okay, wildlife needs food, water, cover, and breeding areas. The cup plant provides them all because the cups catch rainwater, so you've got water. Birds love the seeds because they're very similar to sunflowers. Also, a lot of insects will come to the flowers as well as to the water. And so there's another source of food for birds. And then you've got the cover. When you plant a bunch of them together, it's this big, dense stand, and so birds can hide in there. And finally, the stems are used for singing perches for birds in the spring if you leave them stand up over the winter. So it provides everything you need for birds. But, my God, those seeds, they are that plant is aggressive by seed, so beware when you plant the lovely cup plant.
Okay.
So ironweed is not going to compete with it to any significant matter because the ironweed will get, depending on the species, 6 feet. If you get the tall ironweed, 8-9 feet, but the cup plant's going to get 12 feet, and it's going to have those big spreading leaves, and you're going to – they might coexist. Let's put it that way. You'll be lucky if they coexist. So I hope that helps. Good luck.
Good luck, Dustin. Thank you so much for calling. Jeannie and Phillips called to ask how to get rid of big blue stem in her prairie garden.
Ooh, that's a great question. Yes, this is a problem that we have is because our prairies and our prairie gardens, and first of all, this is one of the garden design considerations, okay? Generally speaking, avoid the tall grasses. If you want flowers in a prairie garden, do not plant big blue stem. Do not plant Indian grass. Do not plant switchgrass, okay? You know, some people will put in Canada wild rye. It's a short-lived perennial, so it usually lives 4 or 5 years, and then it fades away unless it self-sows. But if you want nice display of flowers, use the short prairie grasses like prairie drop seed, which is an absolutely gorgeous grass, little blue stem, and side oats grandma. These are our three go-to grasses for prairie gardens. Some people in a drier soil, sandy soil, will use the more demure June grass. Some people will plant some other of the small Aragrostis. I can never remember the doggone common names, Aragrostis spectabilis, purple lovegrass. Although purple lovegrass, the seed heads separate in the fall and blow all over your yard and into your garage. I have a nice collection of purple lovegrass seed heads in my garage every fall. And they also, some people don't like them because they'll crawl up your leg, up your pants leg. And another name for it is petticoat climber. There's an old name for you. Petticoat climber, isn't that great? That's very colorful. At any rate, so you want to use the shorter grasses because they will allow the flowers to really, really show off, and they're not as aggressive as the tall grasses. So how do we get rid of big blue stem or Indian grass or switchgrass? Okay, we have a couple of different options. Okay, one is to cut them back when they start to send up their seed stalks. Cut them all the way back to the ground, leaves and everything, when they start to send up their seed stalks, because that is the point at which those plants are the weakest, because they're taking energy out of their roots. When I say weakest, I mean their root reserves are lowest. So you attack them when they're the weakest, and then they have to recover. Okay, so or you can just cut, if it's a garden, you can cut them back, you know, every month until you kill them. Because if you keep cutting the leaves back, you will eventually kill the plants if you have only 10 or 12 of them. If you have hundreds of them, then this is going to be a big job. Okay, so that is one option. But because if you're only going to do it a few times a year, you can do this when they're at the weakest point, and then maybe later that season when they regrow a month later after you cut them during the flowering stage, then you can cut them back again, and this will really harm them. If you have a larger area, you can use herbicides, you can use grass selective herbicides. And the best time to use them on the big blue stem is in late June and early September. And big blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass. Okay, there are three different types of grass selective herbicides, and I will list those. I will list the active ingredient. One is called Cefoxitum, S as in Sam, E, T as in Tom, H O X, Y, D as in David, I M, Cefoxitum. This is commonly sold as Post, P-O-A-S-T. Then you have a close relative called Clethodim, C-L-E-T-H-O-D-I-M. This is commonly sold as Select or Envoy Plus, E-N-V-O-Y Plus. And then you have fluazafop P. butyl, but let's just forget that. We'll just use the name is commonly sold under, and that is Fusilade, F-U-S-I-L-A-D-E. It is also sold as Ornamec. Okay, so those are your three grass selective herbicides, and you can spray them. Remember, they're going to kill your little blue stem, your side gramma. Any grasses will be affected by it if it comes in contact with it. But this is pretty effective. You'll have to do this for a couple years in a row because it doesn't just kill them outright. But these are grass selective herbicides. They will not affect your flowers when used according to directions. And so you can go out there and whack away, either whack away at the specific times by cutting back the grasses, or you can go in there usually in late June, late August, early September, and spray them with these grass selective herbicides.
You mentioned, of course, we were talking about big blue stem, and Gene in Knapp, Wisconsin, has a question relating to big blue stem. Let's go there. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Neil, we have been speaking with some people from the Audubon Society, and one of the things that they are desiring is to have a late-season harvest of hay instead of so that you don't harvest till after August 1st. And they suggested big blue stem would be a good species to plant. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts with respect to the, shall we say, the nutritional value of hay from big blue stem.
Sure. And you're looking at for forage for cows, horses? What is this for?
Yeah, for ruminants.
For ruminants. Okay, any in particular?
No.
Okay. So I'm not an expert at this, but I've done some work on it. If you look at the warm season prairie grasses, meaning that they are most active during the warmer times of the year, they can have up to 15, even close to 20% protein, depending upon the soil, the year, the rainfall, et cetera, which is not bad for a grass. Okay. Sometimes during drought, they can go down to 8 to 12%, so it does depend upon the species, the timing, et cetera. Generally speaking, my understanding is that you will get the highest nutritional value, the highest protein levels, usually just before fruiting begins, which is usually late July, early August. And most birds, grassland nesting birds, which is why Audubon is interested in this, I'm sure, is because grassland nesting birds have usually fledged by mid-July. So it's usually safe enough, unless they had disturbances to their nest and they had to re-nest later in spring and they still have young on the nest until the latter part of July, then you might run into a problem. But generally, late July, early August is the recommended time to harvest these warm season grasses, such as big blue stem, Indian grass, and switchgrass. So and it's a one-year cutting, and that does not harm the plants to cut them once a year. It's just it's not an issue. It's just like being grazed by bison. And then you just let them recover and come back the next year, and you can do an annual harvest. The actual tonnage, of course, will depend upon the soil type, the productivity, the fertilization program, the rainfall, or irrigation if you have it, but it hardly pays to irrigate prairie grass because it's not a high-value crop. So that is my limited knowledge of these grasses. Little blue stem is highly, highly nutritious. It's one of the more preferred grasses, but it does not have the same level of production because it is a shorter stature grass and you don't get the same production per acre.
Yeah.
Big blue stem has deep roots. Indian grass has deep roots. Switchgrass has deep roots. They're all very good producers, and they will grow on a variety of soils, from sandy soils to clay soils.
Gene, there you go. Pretty good description for you there, and thank you very much for calling. Steve in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. Steve, hi.
Howdy. So, Neil, I've got two questions. I thought of another one while I was waiting on hold. And the first question, though, is about sweetgrass. So I have a locust tree in my front yard, and we did a prairie planting, you know, all natural and native stuff. A couple of years ago, but now I'm finding that the sweet grass is like way too aggressive, and so it is starting to push out some other things. Any way to get rid of or to pull that back a little bit without individually pulling out pieces of sweet grass?
You're a lucky dude. Sweet grass, Heraclea odorata, the sweet grass that you make braids out of, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Wow, you're lucky. You must have pretty rich soil. Is that correct?
Really?
Pretty good ground.
Wow, I never thought of that. I'm in Milwaukee, it's kind of clay, but I don't know, yeah. I suppose.
Clay can be very productive, and it holds moisture. That's exactly what sweetgrass likes. Wow. Yeah, it's a rhizomatous species. In really good conditions, it will form mats. For me, in the sand, it just has little wispy little runners, and it's like, why can't you grow better here? So it just goes to show the differences in the soils. So I have never tried to control sweetgrass. I've tried to encourage it. My experience, I don't have any experience in controlling it. But as we talked earlier, you can harvest it, and that will at least I don't know if that's going to stop it, because oftentimes what happens when you harvest a grass, it will just it will stimulate it to generate more runners and grow sideways. So that may not help. The other choice is to go in there with a grass selective herbicide like we talked about. But I don't think I'd want to use herbicides on my sweet grass, especially if I'm making braids out of it or using it for smudges. So that's not real good. I've been doing this 45 years. This is a completely unique question. I don't know. I mean, you could dig it out and remove the entire root mass, but if you have remnant areas, it's just going to move back in by rhizomes.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
I'm sorry. This is out of my area of expertise. I really can't help you on
that. A new first for you there, Neil.
There've been a couple other stumps there.
There you go, Steve. Thank you so much. And Peggy and Brilliant, your turn. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. Neil, I talked to you last summer when you were on. I was on my way to Fleet Farm to work in the garden center, and I'm going there again, unfortunately not to work in the garden center, not this time of year. But I just wanted to call and ask if I have this right now, because I'm going to start this spring. We put in a huge septic and mound, and the ground is settled there really well, but there's clumps of grass growing all over it. So my thing is to spray it all summer. Then do I till before I put the wildflower mix on? And also, do I cover it with dross after because I have birds. Oh, my God. I have birds that come through my place because they know I feed.
Sure. Okay. Well, I don't know exactly what you have growing there. So it's hard for me to say what would be the best approach. It depends on the species. Some species are easy to kill and some are hard to kill. So the time frame and the time required to get everything under control will depend upon that. So if you have quackgrass in there that's been all mixed around, those roots are going to come up over a period of months. So a single application of herbicide in May won't kill it, because you'll have all these roots that are coming up later in June and July, just because they're all at different levels in the soil during the construction process. So it really depends upon what you're trying to kill. So the safest thing to do, as you point out, is to spray it three times during the growing season, probably once in late May, early June. And let's make something very clear about quackgrass. If you're going to use glyphosate on quackgrass, you must wait until it is at the four-leaf stage, meaning it has four fully developed leaves coming off the main stem, upward stem. That's usually when it's about 10 to 12 inches tall. If you spray it with glyphosate prior to that, it will burn the leaves back, but will not kill the roots. So you have to wait until, you have to fatten it up for the kill. So wait until it's about a foot tall and then spray it, which will probably be sometime in early June, depending on your latitude. And then you let it sit. And if there's a really thick, dense amount of it, you cut down the brown dead material just so it doesn't intercept your second spraying or third spraying. And then you wait about 2 months until it recovers. Spray it a second time and wait another 2 months and then kill it again a third time in September. Now, do you want to till? No, you don't want to till because you'll bring up weed seeds. So I'm assuming this is sandy, rocky backfill. Is that correct? Or did they put topsoil on?
No. Nope. They put 5 inches of topsoil. I actually called your office last fall wanting to order a wildflower mix to get it on yet last year. And the lady on there told me, no, wait a year, spray it three times next year, then put it on next fall. So, yeah.
Yep. That is a safe way to do it. Absolutely right. Now, you cannot use the septic mix on this because you've got that topsoil in there, so you can use any one of any other medium soil mixes, because I'm assuming that topsoil, you're in Brilliant, so there's probably nice loamy soil, silt loam, clay loam, and so you'll need to use a medium soil mix that is designed for that kind of topsoil. Okay, so don't use the septic mix. Those are dry, sandy plants that will not grow in that good soil. Okay, and then you just have to go out there and just rake it lightly. I mean, just an inch. Okay, so rake it lightly and scatter the seed over it, and then rake it in lightly, and then roll it, and then you can put straw over it, or you can put a straw blanket over it. Now, if you're using a straw blanket, an erosion blanket, you want to use a light-duty blanket that you can actually kind of see. It'll just cover the soil. It won't be real thick. And you want to make sure that the netting on the top of that blanket is at least 3/4 inch by 3/4 inch. If they're 1/2 inch or 1/4 inch, they can restrict the emergence of seedlings of the larger prairie flowers. Grasses will come up through it fine because they have a little pointy coleoptile, is what it's called, this pointy little structure that comes up right through the straw. Okay, but the prairie flowers have to crane their neck or whatever you want to call it in order to come up, how seedlings come up, like a bean comes up. And they can get caught in the netting if some of the larger ones get caught in the netting. So make sure the netting is 3/4 inch by 3/4 inch on the top.
Peggy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBoll, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR. We're taking a look at designing, planting, and caring of your prairie garden with our guest today, Neil DeBoll of Prairie Nursery. It's great to have him back. Larry Mueller here. We'll go back to the phones. The number is 800-642-1234. The email ideas at WPR.org. Susie in New Berlin, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. When I heard the phone call about the sweetgrass, I was yelling into the phone, please give it to me, give it to me. I'll come and get it. anyway, I was as surprised as Neil was that somebody would be trying to get rid of that. I have some ideas. One, the first thing I thought of besides me was Indian Community School of Milwaukee. I would bet would send out a delegation and they would dig up whatever he wanted gone. And they have a pretty large area that would have places for sweetgrass if they don't already have it. Also, there are several tribes in Milwaukee. I mean, they have offices in Milwaukee. Obviously, the Potawatomis. And then Oneida has the Southeastern Oneida Tribal Services office. And I could take care of that, actually. The Ojibwe, I think they have an office or two in Milwaukee. And the Ho-Chunks, I think, have an office. And, you know, if not the whole, like, the tribe itself, if they got out that, you know, if any of the members wanted to get hold of this person, they certainly could. And then he could always dig it out, put it in a... like a cardboard box and put it out on the street or sell it.
So there's options there. There's options there. Neil, what do you think?
Interesting. I think it's a great idea if people are interested in that and different groups are interested in that. So I was I was really shocked. Like, wow, too much sweetgrass. Okay. Wow. What a terrible problem to have. But I mean, I understand it because the plant counts creep by rhizome. So it can, you know, can creep through everything and it will do that. So, but that's, you know, it's a, really would be a great way to get a use for the sacramental plant.
Thank you, Susie. Let's go to Bill in Oregon. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry, Neil. 16 years ago, I started replacing roadside long grass with other plants, and through trial and error, I ended up with a roadside prairie garden because they have the highest return rate. And soil's fairly alkaline, it's high in phosphorus, and it's generally less than 18 inches deep. And near the road, it's on top of road fill, and as you move away from the road, it's all glacial fill underneath. And tried a lot of different things with varying success. Monardas do well, mints do well, heleniums, cup plants, and a lot of grasses. And I was just wondering if you might have any ideas on other things that might thrive in this in this kind of layout.
Okay, and this is a, is it a silty soil mixed with gravel and rock, or what exactly is the nature of the soil between the rockier material?
The soil, it tends to be a little dense. There's not much clay. It's it does have a it's got a rocky content to it, especially as you move away from the road. Because I think they just laid a bunch of topsoil on top after they paved the road. But as you move away, it's all kind of slowly built up soil that's on top of a glacial dumping ground.
Well, that's interesting that you have cup plant doing well there, because that's normally a wetland plant, although it grows in any decent medium soil. How tall do your cup plants get?
They get about 12 feet.
Yeah, see, that's normal. You know, if you grow a cup plant on sand, it might only go 5 or 6 feet, but it'll still grow in a garden situation. So that tells me that you've got pretty good soil. If that cup plant is 12 feet tall and you're also growing mountain mint, most of your, depending on the species of mountain mint, our Virginia mountain mint, which is native here, prefers a moist soil or semi-moist soil, whereas other mountain mints grow in drier conditions. So it depends on the species. So it tells me that if these plants are growing that well, you've got a, what we would call a mesic or medium soil situation. So you should be able to grow a wide variety of plants that are adapted to those conditions if those indicator plants are really indicative of what you can do there. So seems to me like you got quite a few options there. It's not going to be restricted. And it's really interesting you bring up the pH. The vast majority, with some notable exceptions, the vast majority of prairie plants do great on pHs up approaching 8, and many will grow in pHs well over 8, up into like 8.2, 8.3. And we've used prairie plants for mitigation situations on slurries and waste products, slag, from steel mills where we had pHs in the 9s, and we would treat them with sulfur to bring them down into the 8.5, 8 to 8.5, and it's amazing how well a lot of the prairie species will do on these extremely high pH soils. But generally, it's rare to see a pH over 7.5, 7.6, maybe 7.7 in Wisconsin, and almost all of these plants, when selected for the right soil texture and drainage, it's almost all of them will do okay in those higher pHs. And remember, in southwestern Wisconsin, you have soils that are dominated by dolomites, limestones, and southeastern Wisconsin. So a lot of these plants grow in these already inherently high pH situations with high calcium and magnesium levels. It's pretty amazing. They really are.
It is. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Listener emailed to ask if there are legal considerations that you might be aware of or best practices to keep in mind when guerrilla gardening with native wildflowers in Wisconsin, specifically in regarding to public places.
Oh, my God, guerrilla gardening?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I don't do guerrilla gardening. Sometimes it's a waste of time because you may not get the desired result. Oh, boy, this is a good one. You know, when you look at this, we've been through how many legal battles in the last 50 years with ordinances that are completely and utterly absurd, where you have this caste system of plants. If you look at it, the trees are the Brahmins. They are the upper caste, followed by shrubs, followed by flowers. And, of course, lawn is sacrosanct. They're the ultimate gods. Okay, but you have, like, wildflowers and grasses. They're in the lower caste. And then, God forbid, ferns and mosses and, you know, things like that. They're way down there. And so there's this whole thing. You can't have herbaceous plants over 6 inches tall, or this weed police will come and mow down your wildflowers. But it's always fine to have a shrub that's 30 feet tall. It's fine to have a tree that's 100 feet tall. So why would you discriminate against flowers? This is just insane. It's just crazy insane. And so my whole life has been spent trying to get people to accept this, and so that we won't have to do guerrilla gardening, that we can do real life gardening where these plants are accepted as members of society, as full-fledged members in good standing of the gardens, and that you don't have these crazy people coming in and say that we need to mow them down to turn them into completely dead lawns. So, but if you're going to guerrilla garden, make sure you do it safely. It's like, don't plant tall plants on corners where cars come, because it's going to get mowed down for sure, you know, on vehicle areas. And there's all sorts of things. And like, I don't know. This is so far out of my realm of normality. I don't know how to respond. I really don't. But I think you're going to be better off by convincing people to do it on their own properties, and spreading the good word that, hey, these plants are good for us. And it's good for not only good for the environment, it's good for our souls.
Yes. Yes, it is. Oh, man. Paul wonders in Green Bay if you have any ideas for native flowering plants for woods shade. And, of course, native flowering plants for woods.
How much time you have, Paul? I think we got a news break coming up here. What do I got, 2 minutes here, Larry?
A minute and a half or so.
Okay, so there's so many different wildflowers, ferns, sedges. I mean, don't forget the sedges. Sedges are the grasses of the woods. And, of course, there are grasses that grow in the woods, too. There's some really beautiful grasses that grow in the woods, like beak grass, B-E-A-K. There's a plant that's not native to Wisconsin called northern sea oats. It's arguably one of our most ornamental grasses. It grows into north-central Illinois. It does fine in southern Wisconsin. I use it to fight garlic mustard. It is a bit aggressive. It can be aggressive by seeds. It is not native to Wisconsin, so if you want to make sure it is originally native to Wisconsin, although with climate change, who cares anymore? It's all changing. So, but that's. And then there are a number of different sedges, which are grass-like plants, but they're not grasses, and they're little, great little ground covers. And then you've got your trilliums, you've got your Mertensia, Virginia bluebells, and I mean the list just goes on and on. But you can go to our website, and we do list plants for woodland gardens and for woodland situations, as well as prairie situations and for moisture soils. So I mean, it also depends on your soil. You need a good, rich soil to grow most of the showy wildflowers that we see in our woods, like the trilliums, like the bloodroots, etc. When you get into dry, sandy soils under pines and oaks, then, oh, it's just the most difficult landscaping situation. Those showy wildflowers, very few showy wildflowers grow in those conditions, so it's very difficult to landscape. And that's where you move into using dryland ferns, ferns that do well in dry conditions, which you're going to deal with more textures than you are with colors. So you'll work with things like marginal wood fern, Dryopteris marginalis. You can also use Christmas fern, which is fairly good for those situations, though it doesn't like it too dry. So
know your
soils and know your plants.
Neil DeBull, our guest. Neil is president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist, and his book, it's a very popular book, it's titled The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. He's a consulting ecologist. It's great to have him back with us as we talk about design, planting, care of prairie gardens. And I hope you'll join in. Open lines get you on fairly quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Neil, Melissa emailed, she bought a new house and there's grass everywhere, including the flower beds. What suggestions do you have to begin a transition to prairie? And of course, she's an amateur. And it's she bought a new house. I don't know if it's a new house or if it's just a new house to her. But she says there's grass everywhere, including in her flower beds.
So grass meaning like turf grass?
I'm expecting it to be turf grass, yeah.
Sure, okay. Well, it depends on what her ultimate goals are. So this is when, especially when you move into a new house or you build a new house, it's really important to have an overall landscape plan. Now, you can hire somebody to do this for you, or you can teach yourself and learn how to do it. And this is all part of the fun, is doing the trial and error landscaping plan program, which many of us have done. And again, you can go to a professional, but a lot of people, you want to make sure that you hire somebody that's consistent with your goals and has the knowledge and expertise to achieve your goals, because a lot of landscapers don't have the experience with native plants. So you want to be very selective in this regard. But either way, you want to make sure before you start that you have a cohesive plan for what you want to create. And that comes down to, okay, what do I like? What kind of plants do I like? And then what are my ecological goals? Do I want to create a wildlife haven? If so, I'm going to need native trees, native shrubs, native wildflowers, all the different elements that work together. For instance, if I want butterflies, most butterflies will nectar on prairie plants, but their larval stage, their caterpillars, are going to eat, not in every case, but in most cases, are going to eat the leaves of trees and shrubs. So you have to make sure you have all the elements there to achieve your landscape goals, especially if you're planting for wildlife. And then if you're planting for birds, you want to make sure that you're putting in species that not only attract the insects, and I mean, prairie flowers are unsurpassed at bringing in insects. So that's such an important food for adult birds as well as their young birds, especially caterpillars. And then you want to make sure that you have all the other aspects that that tie together to provide all the different cover, food, and other needs at every life stage. So you want to have a master plan. Now, when you have grass everywhere, what you can do is, if once you've decided what your plan is, you can just go in and put in trees or shrubs into that grass, because there's not a lot of, you know, detail involved in that. That's pretty simple. And you don't necessarily have to mulch everything. You can just mow between the shrubs to keep a little bit of grass there. If you are putting in a prairie garden, it's really important to make sure that it is acceptable. If you're in a neighborhood, make it acceptable to your neighbor. So don't plant the prairie garden right on the edge of the property with your neighbor, like, hey, thumbing your nose at them and they don't like it. So what we typically will do is we will create prairie gardens within the lawn, like a little oval or a kidney or something like that, that looks like a planned garden. And nobody would know that it's a prairie garden. It's just a perennial garden. So nobody gets all freaked out because it's surrounded by grass. And so you have those elements of the lawn there. This presupposes that you don't mind retaining some of the lawn, but this is the way it works in suburban areas where sometimes you get a little pushback. Well, be friendly to your neighbors, leave some lawn, and slowly and gradually install your prairie gardens. It's kind of like boiling a frog. Pretty soon, they don't even know what happened. So you've got prairie frog, you got prairie gardens everywhere, one at a time. Okay, so it's really important, though, to make sure that you do have some vision for that property based upon your own personal goals, and that will be consistent with your management. Okay, how much time are you going to spend on this? Finally, you have invasive grasses like quackgrass, et cetera. So you, if you're putting in a garden, whether it's a perennial garden, a prairie perennial garden, a grass garden, whatever, you may want to put in edging to keep those grasses out, because that's how most grasses get in, is they creep in by rhizomes. Quackgrass is notorious for this. It is indefatigable. So you do need to put in some sort of a border. And you want to make sure that you have eliminated everything in the planting area beforehand so you don't have rhizomes of quackgrass or other weeds that are going to come back and start spreading within that garden because you didn't get rid of them first. So
there we go.
Right. Master plan, phase it in, piece at a time, and then talk to your neighbors. Tell your neighbors what you're doing. Tell them what your plan is so they're not feeling like they're just getting blindsided. Hey, I'm putting in a pollinator garden. It's not a prairie garden. It's my, I'm putting in a pollinator, butterfly, and bird garden. Ooh, that sounds good. Okay, there you go. It's all marketing.
Neil DeBolle, and I should say, I've been online to your website, prairienursery.com, and you have some of the best suggestions for practically anything relating to prairies on that website.
Well, thank you, Larry. That's that's 45 years of my work. And then we have other people here who do this, especially our web designer, catalog designer, Mary Evans. She does some wonderful, wonderful work. And just that website, she gets the credit for that. She's brilliant. And she has also produced some wonderful articles, too. So between all of us here, we our goal is to educate. And I tell people we have three products at Prairie Nursery: plants, seeds, and education. And without education, we can't sell the other items. So we want to make sure that our customers know exactly how to do it right, and get it right the first time.
Amy in Milwaukee emailed, will straight vinegar sprayed on weeds kill them off? Is it better, equal to, or not as good as using chemicals, other chemicals, because that's a chemical? How long after killing the weeds should she wait before planting flowers or plants?
Okay, so we have a couple of different questions here. First of all, there are vinegar herbicides and there are other acid-based herbicides, which are very good at killing annuals. They will kill almost all annuals, and they'll kill some biennials in their first year. Now, biennials, of course, they germinate and grow the first year, mostly creating a basal rosette or a stem, and then they develop, in almost every case, a taproot, and then in the second year, they grow some more, flower, make seeds, and die. When in their first year, they're similar to an annual, and so they can usually be killed with a concentrated vinegar or other similar organic acid. Again, there are many organic acid herbicides on the market. However, this does not work on most perennials, especially rhizomatous or taprooted perennials. It only will burn back the leaves. They turn brown. It looks like you killed them, but it doesn't kill the roots. And this is the difference between most of your organic acid herbicides and a general-purpose herbicide like glyphosate, i.e. Roundup, is that these are systemic herbicides. Roundup, glyphosate, is a systemic herbicide that is translocated down into the roots where it kills the root. And so some people have been rudely surprised when they thought they had killed the plants with their organic acids, but they didn't, because they looked dead, but the roots were still alive. So repeated applications will be necessary, and it's not dissimilar from, as we talked about earlier, digging up the plants to expose their roots and kill them repeatedly, let them resprout to get some energy out of that root, and then attack them again with cultivation. In this situation, you can allow the plants to resprout after the first application of organic acid, let it get up, kill the leaves again, let them resprout, and do this repeatedly until you have completely exhausted the roots. So it is an organic method, but it takes longer typically than a systemic herbicide like glyphosate. So that is an option there. And with vinegar, with glyphosate, it allegedly breaks down upon contact with the soil, and I have seen that in my own experience where I seeded some no-mow lawn grass. It hadn't come up yet. I had a few weeds that I had not killed. I went out and sprayed it with glyphosate on Sunday evening at 7 p.m., and the next morning I walked outside at 7 a.m. to go to work, and there were seeds of the grass coming up right where I had sprayed 12 hours later. Those seeds had germinated, but they had roots going down but no leaves. Their leaves came up overnight right after I had sprayed it. And obviously there was no damage. That lawn is still beautiful lawn today, 25 years later. So it supposedly, glyphosate breaks down upon contact with soil. There is some contention on this. I am not a scientist or a chemist. I'm a scientist, but not a chemist. So I don't know. But there is almost no lead time required after spraying. Most people say 24 hours. But if you are waiting for weeds to die, you have to wait 4 to 7 days for the weeds to truly die from glyphosate before you disturb them to till them up. So the planting, if it's associated with tilling, then you would have to wait 4 to 7 days.
Jim emailed to ask, what is a good time to burn prairie gardens this year? He has a quarter acre, probably 6 or 7 years old, but it's never burned it.
You definitely need to burn. The best way to manage a prairie is to burn it, because prairies are fire-adapted ecosystems. And so when you're burning a prairie, you have to ask yourself, what is my management goal? What am I trying to achieve by burning? And what is the ecological structure of that prairie? Is it a mesic prairie where most of the plants are, or a medium soil prairie, or a wet prairie where most of the plants are active in the summer and the fall? Late summer and early fall. Or is it a dry prairie where a lot of the plants are active in very early spring, like passflowers or violets or prairie smokes, very early blooming plants, which come up early, so you have to burn them early, or you can burn them in the fall so you don't damage the spring blooming flowers. So most of the time when we're dealing with dry prairies, we want to burn them in the fall so we don't hurt the early blooming flowers. On a medium soil or mesic prairie, typically our biggest problems are invasive, non-native, cool season Eurasian grasses like quackgrass, bluegrass, fescues, and smooth brome. And so if that's a problem, then we wait until mid-spring, usually for best results, when the buds of the sugar maple tree, Acer saccharum, are just breaking open. Not red maple, not silver maple. Those are usually 10 to 14 days earlier before the sugar maple. You wait until the quackgrass, bluegrass, et cetera, is up 3, 4, 5 inches, expending its root reserves to make new growth, before you burn, so that you can damage those plants, and you want to remove all of the litter that is preventing the sun from hitting the soil directly and warming it up into the zone where the primarily warm season prairie plants have an advantage, where they grow faster with warmer soil. So it's a double duty thing. You damage the non-wanted clovers. This is another way to get rid of white clover. Burn it in mid-spring. Okay. Usually, again, when the buds of the sugar maple are opening. You can't tell a date. The date can vary by a month, but the plants never lie. They're always aligned. So if you burn at that time, which will harm some of your emerging prairie flowers, because some of the prairie flowers and some of the cool season prairie grasses are coming up, but they have a longer season than they're going to bloom in the summer, so they'll recover, and they'll recover more quickly. Okay, so we would normally burn every 2 years to keep woody plants out. Some people will go to 3 years. But this method then, by burning, the soil turns black and absorbs the heat of the sun, and that moves it away from the temperature regime where the cool season weeds and grasses do best into the warmer regime where the prairie flowers, most prairie flowers and grasses do best, and changes the entire balance. So it all depends upon what your goals are, what the nature of your prairie is, et cetera. And I'll tell you, if you have reed canary grass and you have it in a sedge meadow with some good native sedges and wildflowers, here is an amazing way to really whack that reed canary grass, is to burn it in June when the reed canary grass is in flower. Now, this is the nastiest, smokiest, most horrible, acrid smoke you will probably ever see outside of a house fire. But I've done these. But my God, the results are incredible. It just whacks the heck out of the reed canary grass, and the sedges and the native flowers recover by August. It's just like magic. If you can't burn then, and you have a reed canary grass with some decent members of the sedge meadow, you can mow it in mid-June when it's in flower rather than burn it. So you have mowing and you have burning. If you can't burn, you can substitute mowing and raking for burning at approximately the same time as you would have burned it. And by mowing and raking, you wait until the cool season grasses come up and weeds. You mow it right down to the ground with a mower set on the lowest setting, remove the cutting so it exposes the soil, and it's about 50% as effective as burning.
There we go. Let's go to Dave in Janesville next. Hi, Dave.
Yes, good morning. I've got a native prairie I've been trying to maintain for 30 years. It's a hillside, xeric up above and mesic below. And turkeys over the last few years have totally devastated everything. They're digging it up. Is there any way I can deter the turkeys from destroying my prairie?
Lead poisoning.
Yeah.
It's called a shotgun. In season, of course. I have the same problem at my house. And they don't destroy my prairie so much. They rummage around in my woods. I do these woodland restorations, and then I'll go out and I grow all these woodlands, just wonderful woodland flower seeds of trilliums and bloodroot, and I put them out, and then the turkeys rustle around in there all winter and eat them up. It drives me crazy. So you can get a dog or maybe get a pack of wolves if you can encourage them to come by. But, you know, dogs are really good at chasing away turkeys. But, you know, I don't know if you have a leash law and you have neighbors that would shoot dogs running around because, you know, wild dogs are not particularly well received in our agricultural areas. So, but, yeah, well, turkeys have become a real issue in restoration. Almost not as bad as deer, of course. It consume everything. But
yeah.
maybe somebody else has some ideas on how to control turkeys. I have a 10-foot high fence around my vegetable garden and my orchard to keep deer out. It doesn't keep the turkeys out. They will fly in, but they don't generally go in there. They walk around the edges of it and do their little thing. They rarely fly in. So, I don't know.
There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Steve emailed, all of his bee balm died off after flourishing for a couple of years. Wondered what might have happened, and is there a solution?
You know, bee balm can be pretty touchy. I've had problems with it in my garden, and I thought I put it in just the right spot. You know, semi-sun, nice rich soil where it would expect to be. I think that it just isn't that long-lived. And I think, plants have longevities. And this is one of the interesting things in our book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, is that we actually list the longevity of plants, which most people don't include in books. I mean, I've actually never seen a book that lists the longevity of species, each species. So bee balm is, from what I can tell, a relatively short-lived plant. I have never seen it live much more than 5 years. Now, that's just me. Maybe other people have had better results with it. And there could be other factors, but it might have just reached the end of its life cycle. Although 3 years seems a little bit short, but yeah. I have never had mine last more than 5 years personally. So,
Chris emailed. He's a sustainable management grad student in Kenosha, and wonders if you could offer a couple of resources to which he can refer to better understand suitable hardy, low maintenance, and low height ground cover options to plant. One variety in a space in place of grass within parking lot medians.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, a resource for that. Well,
you got that in the Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants?
you know, there are individual plants that are listed. For that, we don't really go into ground covers. And I'll be honest, the reason why is that the most of your ground, really, the aggressive ground covers are not native. And so most of the ground covers that people use and can be actually be quite problematic. So I understand exactly what he's trying to get at. There are plants and that we do list, and you can go to our website and we do list them. So I would suggest that he just go to our website. There's a ton of information there. We do list some native ground covers that might be appropriate. I mean, some that you could consider include mist flower. Now, mist flower is not native to Wisconsin. It grows fine here, but it grows a little east of us. Okay. Wild stone crop. Okay. Also, this is more of an Appalachian plant. Okay. I'm assuming this is a sunny location. You can put in plants like heath aster. It used to be Aster ericoides. Now it's Symphyotrichum ericoides. All the asters have been deported to the genera Symphyotrichum, Oligarnaron, Eurybia, et cetera. There are no asters left. But anyway, heath aster H-E-A-T-H. It creeps by rhizomes to form these nice little bushes. It grows in really austere soil, really rough soil conditions. It's really incredibly tough. So that's a possibility. You can use some grasses, prairie drop seed, Spirobolus heterolepis. This is a beautiful grass, extremely long-lived, very tolerant of alkaline soil conditions and relatively salt-tolerant. Is a great possibility. Do not, whatever you do, deposit salt onto your prairie plantings. And I had a parking lot project up in Wausau where we did this, and they changed their snow plowing company, and they pushed the snow with the salt onto the prairie on this hillside that we had stabilized. We saved them tens of thousands of dollars by planting prairie for a few thousand dollars rather than putting in a retaining wall. It worked great. And they pushed snow over it, and it killed all the flowers in 1 year. But the grasses were fine. They're much more salt tolerant, but it killed every single flower. There were no flowers left after 1 winter of snow plowing. And it was beautiful, covered in flowers, and the salt killed all the flowers. So prairie drop seed is and salt, and little blue stem is moderately salt tolerant. Side oats grandma is much more tolerant, but it is short-lived, so it's not going to give you the same coverage time of these longer-lived short prairie grasses, prairie drop seed, and little blue stem. So they're a little bit taller, and they're flammable, so they're not good for parking lots, because if somebody throws a cigarette in there, it could burn up 20 cars. So prairie grasses in parking lots are really not good. But the sedum is a succulent plant. It is completely non-flammable, so that is good. And the mist flower also does not burn well. So those are just a couple of possibilities. But he can contact me at Prairie Nursery, neil@prairienursery.com, with further questions.
All right. And I think Barbara had a very similar question, and she can probably contact you as well.
Absolutely.
Terry emailed that the pussy toe ground cover sounds perfect, but will it thrive in Bayfield County? Also, do they survive heavy snow?
Pussy toes is fine in Bayfield County. It's a cool season plant as long as it's in a very dry soil, sandy or rocky soil. Do not put it in a good soil or a clay soil. It will not do well. It likes terrible sandy, dry conditions, and it makes a great ground cover. Now, there's a great, if you have just dry sand, wow, what a fantastic ground cover that is. And it's a beautiful little thing.
Well, you're going to find some sand in Bayfield County, that's for sure.
Probably, yeah, almost certainly, yeah. So, I don't know. We get snow here, but not like they get the snow belt up there. But I don't know. But it's a pretty tough plant.
Yeah.
It's in the right spot. Yeah, it's a beautiful little plant.
Well, Neil, it's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you. I really appreciate the time that you spend. And I'm sure, a very busy guy right now.
Yeah, we're kind of busy, which is all good. And Larry, I thank you for the honor to be on your show and to interact with your guests. It's one of the highlights of the year for me, and it seems like we just had like 5 minutes in the last hour and a half.
Well, you do a wonderful job. Neil, thank you so much. And we'll look forward to your next visit.
I will look forward to that too, Larry. Thank you again.
Neil DeBole is president of Prairie Nursery. He's a consulting ecologist. His book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, is a dandy, and I tell you what, prairienursery.com is what he mentioned, and think about taking a look there. Oh, and by the way, full disclosure here, we should mention that Prairie Nursery is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors, and they've been doing that for quite a long time, so that's great as well. Looking ahead on Monday at this time, we'll talk with tech expert Jesse LeGrew. If you've had somebody die, a loved one, but that person's digital input footprint is still out there, he'll be talking about how you can do away with that if you'd like. That's on Monday. And, of course, he'll be answering your other IT questions as well. So looking forward to seeing Jesse LeGrew. And looking forward to having you back with us as well. There's always lots in store on the Ideas Network, and there's plenty more to come right through the afternoon. So you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR.